It's my only physicist joke, I think, is speaking about making up the title. It's a physicist walks into a phone booth to make a long distance call, and gets the operator on the phone, and she asks for the number, and he pauses and he says, "I can't remember. Give me a second, and I'll rederive it." Professor Dunlap will speak on how does a circadian clock work, which I thought was fine since I'm first. So we're going to talk about circadian rhythms, partly I wasn't sure what the composition of the audience is going to be. So I'll do a few slides, and then maybe we'll pause and sort of catch up on the biology if it's not clear, and then we'll start an infinite digress into the molecular analyses. I pulled some slides and I tried to put in some others, but obviously you should just stop me if it A is confusing or B is boring, and then we'll move on to something else. All right. See if we can get launched again here. And the wonders of PowerPoint. Here we are. Okay, so some introductory stuff. Circadian rhythms. Circadian rhythms are free-running sustainable oscillations with an approximately 24-hour period length. They're circadian. Universally associated with light and temperature perception, and they are entrained to daily environmental changes. Okay, so as a for instance here, this is two French-Canadian scientists put a microphone in the lodge of Castor canadensis, which all of you will immediately recognize as the North American beaver. This was done between March and April of 1971. So in northern climes, March 18th, it's still very snowy and cold. There's an ice pack over the water. And by April, spring thaws happened and the snow is melted. So when we start off up here, this is a little bit like being at KITP, perhaps. They're hanging out in the lodge, talking to one another. Not a lot to say. Chew some bark, have a late afternoon martini, get up late the next day. And they're running at obviously a longer than 24-hour period length. So these data are what's called double plotted, where this is day one, and day two, and day three, and day three, and day four, and day four, and day five, and day five, and day six, so that you can see trends that follow across the day. So their activity is free running here with a period length that's longer than a day. It's about 27 hours. So here, where sound recording is lost for about a day, is where the spring thaw happened. The cables were washed away. They reestablished them. Beavers undergo a couple of days of transience, and then you see two things that happen. One is they lock on to 24 hours, so they're getting environmental cues now, so they're being reset every day, so that this free running period of 27 has now become 24. And the other is that there's a lot more activity going on. They're just busy as beavers. So entrainment, free running in a circadian period length, and then entrainment to environmental cues. Clock operates.
Are they effectively completely covered by snow and things in the earlier part, so there's not much light difference? Or is
there's not much. They're inside the lodge, so they're heaped with sticks and things, and then the snow and ice on top of that. So effectively, it's pretty much constant temperature and pretty much constant darkness. I speak from my vast experience with the North American beaver.
So how are you supposed to understand the first part as a sort of a slow drift, is it?
No, this is in their little beaver brains, there are Let's see, in the beaver there would be a suprachiasmatic nucleus. So in their beaver brains there's a part of the brain that's set aside for keeping time. And within the cells of that part of the brain there's a biochemical, molecular biochemical genetic feedback loop that's operating, self-sustaining. And that's keeping time for the beaver. And the dynamics of that feedback loop are such that in a beaver it runs at about 27 hours. Clock operates within defined physiological limits. So for a homeotherm, that's perhaps less interesting. For poikilotherms like flies, like plants, like fungi, what you see is even though the organism can live over a very broad range of temperatures, the clock doesn't operate over that whole range, but rather sort of in the mid part of that range. So that for Neurospora, for instance, which is a eukaryotic filamentous fungus, the clock operates between about 18 centigrade and 32 centigrade. For goniolax, which is a dinoflagellate that lives off the coast here, the clock operates between about 12 degrees centigrade and probably 34 degrees centigrade. Same thing for plants. In the temperature extremes, the clock's not operating, but within the mid-range, the clock keeps time. And that's the last part here. The period length of the rhythm is compensated against changes in temperature or metabolic state. So across that temperature range, the period length is pretty much constant. Sometimes there are slight increases, and sometimes there are slight decreases in the period length. So that's how people know that it's not simply temperature independent, but rather there's an active compensation process. And that's something that some of the other speakers are going to talk about. Yeah? There's sort of two questions. Why do they need one? And let's start with that one. So in some ways, if you can't move, you need one even more. So in general, clocks are adaptive. They're not essential. So if you eliminate the clock in any organism, especially in the laboratory, it does just fine. So clocks are used to anticipate daily changes that are going to that have happened for the last couple of billion years, and that'll most likely happen the next day. So plants use them, for instance, for gearing up photosynthesis in anticipation of daytime. So before the sun ever comes up, they've expanded their thylakoids. REBP carboxylase has been made. It's all there. Stomata open so that the CO2 can come in. And they're all set to fix carbon. In fact, plants fix carbon more efficiently during the day than they do at night. It is per photon, the amount of sugar fixed is higher during the day than it is at night. This goniolax that I mentioned earlier is bioluminescent. So when you look in the in a red tide, the bioluminescence in the coming from the water is the single-celled dinoflagellate. It's photosynthetic, so the clock controls its photosynthesis. Clock also controls its bioluminescence, which again sort of teleologically makes sense. If you're a single cell making light, there's no point in doing it during the day because no one will see you anyway. So they gear up the bioluminescence, make the luciferase and the luciferin, and package it into a responsive particle, all in anticipation of nighttime. Okay. So where are they found? Systems in blue here are groups of organisms where circadian rhythms have been found, and in red are the actual organisms that people are working on at the molecular level. So this is just a broad, unrooted tree of life with the three major assemblages of organisms: archaebacteria, eubacteria, and eukaryotes. No clocks described yet in archaebacteria, although people have looked. Within the eubacteria, there's only one group, the cyanobacteria, that have true circadian rhythms by all of these characteristics. And that's a good place to pause. So there are many rhythms in nature. Some are mildly self-sustaining, some are strongly self-sustaining, and some are just hourglasses that are not self-sustaining at all. Some of them have period lengths of anywhere from 2 hours on up to, bamboo or 99 years, I think, the fruiting cycle. So there's a group of these that are around 24 hours that are circadian, but not every 24-hour rhythm is a circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm have these defined characteristics. They can be reset by brief changes in the environmental regimen, the temperature compensated. In yeast, is there a circadian clock? No. There's no photobiology in yeast either. And there's generally a good correlation between whether an organism cares to perceive light and whether it cares to keep time. If yeast had a clock, we'd be working on yeast. Cyanobacteria have a clock, and people study the molecular basis of that in Senecococcus. In the eukaryotes, among the protista, Euglena, Tetrahymena, have clocks, dinoflagellates, ciliates, and then these are the so-called crown eukaryotes. They're thought to have all emerged at the Cambrian explosion. And there's a blow-up of these up here. All of the major groups of, or all of the groups of organisms in the crown eukaryotes have clocks. Following this branch pathway, there's a common ancestor someplace back here. Plants branch off from animals and fungi here, and fungi branch off from animals here. So people are actively studying clocks in plants, and Arabidopsis, Chlamydomonas. Among the animals and insects, and Anthera, some an enormous amount of work in Drosophila that Mike will talk about later. In the animals, a lot of work being done in mouse, and by extension in humans. And in fungi, work being done chiefly in Neurospora. So one of the reasons why yeast, for instance, are such a good model for understanding processes in animals is because of this. The last major branch between animals and something else is between animals and the fungi. That's why fungi tend to be good models. So what are clocks used for? And this is getting to the question that you had asked. A couple of sort of major classes of uses. One is programming activities, appropriate activities to appropriate times of day. So if you're a plant, appropriate is photosynthesis, and so they gear up photosynthesis. If you're an animal, it could be activity, and depending on the biology of the animal, some animals are active at night, like mice. Some animals are active during the day, like us. Within people, almost any physiological parameter you can imagine, you can think of, is in a large way or small way regulated by your clock. So the obvious ones we see all the time are sleep-wake cycle. For instance, deep core body temperature changes. So when you're staying up all night working on an interesting problem, you feel cold at 4 in the morning. It's because you actually are cold, colder at 4 in the morning. Propensity for sleep changes. So again, if you're staying up all night working, you get pretty tired at 4 and 5 in the morning. But by 9 or 10 in the morning, you're much less tired. And that's the circadian component of the sleep need. Physiologically, blood pressure, hematocrit, circulating hormone levels, timing of cell division in rapidly growing tissues, like hair follicles and intestinal epithelia, sensitivity to pain, peaks about now. So it's a bad time, for instance, to go to the dentist. A good time is in the late afternoon, so a lot of Olympic endurance records are set in the late afternoon. Visual acuity, mental acuity, finger tapping coordination. Let's see, the juxtaposition of the blood pressure and circulating platelet levels means that there's a peak in the blood clotting, which also happens about now. So in fact, the incidence of heart attack peaks about 10 in the morning. So I'll try not to be too exciting.
You said there was some shorter rhythms, a couple of hours.
Yes.
In the what virtue is that for
me? It's not clear. It's not used to, you know, so for instance, we were talking last night about in development, so sure. It'd be used for timing things, but in terms of the environment or interface with the environment, there would be probably none. Yeah. All right. So I put this together about 40 minutes ago. So we'll see how this goes. And the wonders of PowerPoint. You can see that as I animated about 40 minutes ago. So if some things are out of order, that's why. So what are some common themes in how to build these? There are positive elements and negative elements. So what I'm going to try to do is put together a feedback loop. So these are molecularly described positive elements in Neurospora, in Drosophila, and in mammals. And these are molecularly described negative elements in Neurospora, Drosophila, and in mammals. What I didn't have time to animate was something even more basic than this. So we all know the central dogmas. We have DNA makes RNA makes protein. If you had a protein that regulated the first step of that DNA making RNA, then you'd have a feedback loop. All right, maybe a transcription translation based negative or positive feedback loop. So loops like that are what clocks are built around. All right, so here we have positive elements turning on clock genes making RNA, making protein, the protein feeding back and blocking the activity of the positive elements. So that's a negative feedback loop. I'm sorry? You could say gene product. Yep. Trying to be more global. So these are proteins that act negatively. So that's sort of a core feedback loop. And then on that, we see, so I should say, the negative elements then are these. In Neurospora, white collar 1 and white collar 2 are positive elements. They turn on the transcription of frequency, which makes RNA, which makes protein, and frequency blocks the activity of white collar 1 and white collar 2. In flies, clock and cycle are positive elements. They turn on expression of period and timeless, which are negative elements. Period and timeless together block the activity of clock and cycle. All right. Adding to this, then, the negative elements, in many cases, promote the expression of at least one of the positive elements. So that's a positive feedback loop joined to the negative feedback loop. So, for instance, frequency promotes the expression of white collar 1 in Neurospora. And for output, one of the ways that you can get output is if these positive elements control the expression of genes that did not feed back. It simply fed out to give rhythmic expression in biochemistry. There are lots of examples of these. All right, so some common themes. Transcription, translation-based feedback loops with transcription factors as positive elements and proteins that block the activity of these factors as negative elements. These are seen in all the eukaryotic clocks. Is rhythmic expression seen in transcripts and proteins correspond to the negative elements. So all of these are rhythmically expressed. Positive elements are heterodimers comprised of two proteins that interact via pass domains. So white collar 1 and white collar 2 are two different proteins, and they interact to make a heterodimer. And that heterodimer is the transcription factor. Likewise, clock and cycle interact via pass domains, and clock and BML in mammals interact via pass domains to make a heterodimeric transcription factor.
Would it be impolite to ask why they were called white collar in Neurospora?
No, it's a wonderful question, of course. Anything about Neurospora is a wonderful question. The Neurospora being a filamentous fungus, people will keep stocks on slants. On slants, on a back, so it's a test tube with auger in it, and when the auger is soft, you tilt it on its side so that instead of a circle of auger, you have an ellipse of auger so that you have more of a surface. So when they inoculate and they grow up towards the top, then there's a collar of auger around the top. The growth cycle, and we'll get to this a little later, Neurospora will normally grow across the surface as surface mycelia, but it develops to make aerial hyphae, which have spores. And in wild type, the spores have carotenoids, so they're yellow. In the spores, the carotenoid production is constitutive, so they're always yellow. In the mycelia, carotenoid production is light-induced. So in the dark, they're white. In the light, they're yellow. So in a wild-type slant, the mycelia are yellow, the conidia are yellow. It looks yellow-orange. In a mutant that can't see light, the mycelia are white, and the spores are yellow. So if you look at a slant from the side, it has this little white collar. Yes. And of course, they are controllers, right? Yes. The question is whether it's clear in mammals that the basis of the clock is the molecular feedback loop rather than a neuronal network. That is absolutely clear. Neuronal networks are essential for getting the information out of the clock to the organism, but the basis of the clock happens in biochemistry that happens within cells. So individual cells are rhythmic. So then the overall model then is that in your brain now, in a bunch of neurons that are right in back of the palate, pretty much, in the hypothalamus, there are two bundles of neurons called the, in fact, they sit right on top of the optic chiasm, so they're called the suprachiasmatic nuclei. And within each of these bundles of neurons, there are cells, about 8 to 10,000 in each half, and their function in life is to keep time. They take light information that comes in here and goes back here, so they can be synchronized to the environment. But in the absence of any environmental cues, just like in the beaver, they're keeping time, and they're sending that time information out into the rest of the brain through both the humoral and neuronal networks, and then from the brain out into the body to do all this other stuff. Good question. Past domain. Past domains are protein, or domains that are involved in promoting protein-protein interactions. PASS is an acronym. It comes from the first three proteins identified with them, and that was PER in Drosophila, PER ARNT, it's the aryl hydrocarbon nuclear translocator. It's what gets dioxin signals in, and single-minded, which is a Drosophila neurogenesis gene. There are proteins involved in protein-protein interaction.
And the domains that conserved among all these
species? Yeah. So the question is, are the domains conserved among all these species? Yeah. So if you do a blast search, that is, does everybody know what a blast search is? Okay, good. So if you do a blast search with PASS from one organism, you'll pick up all of these other ones. They're sort of loosely, they're about 150 amino acids long in two groups of around 50 with a spacer in between. So a single PASS is this region of about 50. And if you take the PASS from any one of these, you'll pick up all the rest of these, along with a bunch of other things. PASS domains are involved in many processes, not just in clocks.
That's highly conserved. That's amazing.
Well, it's conserved sufficiently that you can easily pick them up. Yeah. see. Of the proteins comprising the heterodimer, one is generally constitutive and one is rhythmically expressed. So in Neurospora, there's a low amplitude but definite rhythm in white collar one. In Drosophila, the rhythm in clock, and in mammals, there's a rhythm in BMAL. Extended sequence similarity links some of the positive elements among all the systems. So, Lewis, this is related to what you were saying. So, in particular, past domains among all these are related. And the white collar one, the region containing the past domains and surrounding that part shows extended similarity to BMAL and less so to clock, but still detectable. Yeah. I didn't get the constitutively expressed. So in Neurospora, for instance, white collar two is constitutively expressed. That is, the amount of it there does not cycle. The amount of it there is regulated by the loop, but the stability of the protein is such that the protein doesn't cycle. But it's interacting with white collar one, which does. I don't know as we can say that for sure yet.
And how many of these are there? Is it just that they have these positive elements? Is it just one pair or are there other pairs?
Now this is pretty much it, at least for the circadian feedback loops. At least for the core circadian feedback loops. And as we'll see later, it does get more complicated than this. At least one of the negative elements has a dual role in the cycle, performing both a negative function in feedback and also a positive function in promoting the expression of one of the heterodimeric partners. So frequency promotes expression of white collar one. Okay, molecular components of the Neurospora clock then. So here's the feedback loop as we're now understanding it. White collar one and white collar two act positively in the production of freak. So these make a heterodimer, and these act positively on the production of freak. Freak does a couple of things. It acts negatively on the production of its own transcript. So freak protein is made, feeds back, interacts with this heterodimer, and blocks its activity. Blocks its ability to activate transcription. So that's negative feedback. It's yes, it's on another. It's on a site other than the past domain. It interacts with white collar two, not with white collar one. There's a coil domain in freak. And that's required for the interaction, but the actual amino acid residues involved in the contact haven't been.
There's no competition.
Competition between white between the heterodimer and freak. No, they're not competing. No. Nope. So it's not an either or. It's no. Yeah. Is that next? That's okay. Let's just do both of those. So freak acts positively on the production of white collar two transcript. So freak is made and it homodimerizes, and it does a couple of things. It acts positively on the production of white collar two transcript, and it acts positively on the production of white collar one protein. All right, so that's more positive feedback. Freak also becomes phosphorylated. Pretty quickly. There are a couple of kinases that are involved in doing that, and that phosphorylation leads to its turnover. So once freak is made, it's a time bomb. It's becoming phosphorylated and it's processively phosphorylated by these. That is one phosphorylation by one enzyme appears to call down phosphorylation by the other one, so that that takes some time. While it's being phosphorylated, it's still active, so it's holding the activity of its activator in abeyance while making more and more of its activator. And then eventually, when the phosphorylation catches up, Freak precipitously turns over, and that releases all this activator to initiate the cycle again.
So the threshold number of phosphorylation that you have to reach before this happens, or is just a very graded thing?
The question is there a threshold number of phosphorylations before Freak is turned over? The answer is we almost certainly that's the case. But we don't, the sites of all the phosphorylation haven't been mapped yet. So we don't know which ones are, we don't know what the threshold is.
And it's just turnover, or the nuclear import is also controlled by phosphorylation?
No, apparently it's just turnover, so far as we know.
Does phosphorylation depend on whether the frequency is free or bound to whatever white polar?
Does phosphorylation require binding of, apparently not. Freak will be phosphorylated even when it's not bound. Yeah, Chris? No, there are no pass domains in Freak, so.
What makes them to bind to
them? It's through a coil domain, which says everything and nothing. Yeah, if that coiled domain is eliminated, then they don't homodimerize anymore.
And then what's the
They are arrhythmic. This is work by E. Liu at Dallas Southwestern.
Does the protease pathway for this include those in the nucleus, or is the import and export from the nucleus unassociated with that?
We don't know. Yes?
Does Freak just sequester WC1 WC2 to release it again when it gets degraded, or does it have to degrade
it? It sequesters them. What it does, and I'll show you some evidence for this later, it keeps them from, it apparently keeps them from binding to DNA, or it shifts the equilibrium from, obviously to be active here, they have to be binding to the Freak promoter. So the presence of Freak shifts that equilibrium so that they're binding less.
So I didn't understand these two positive arrows. There's a white collar 2 and Freak react positively on the level of translation of white collar 1?
We're not sure how Freak, white collar 2 does not. I see these arrows are confusing. White collar 2 has no action on white collar 1. White collar 2 protein just heterodimerizes with white collar 1. Freak acts on both. Freak acts on the production of white collar 2 transcript and thereby protein. And Freak acts somehow to increase the amount of white collar 1 protein. We don't think it's not overall stability. So it could be stability of white collar 1 before it enters the heterodimer. Or it could be a translational effect. Okay, so the result of all of this is that there are these daily rhythms in Freak transcript level and Freak protein level. And the phase of these oscillations has real meaning. Molecular daytime is defined by this elevated Freak, and molecular nighttime by a low level of Freak transcript. Molecular dusk is about the time when the peak in Freak protein occurs, and molecular dawn is close to where the low point occurs. Yeah?
There must be some place where white collar 1 and 2 are degraded,
no? They don't need to be degraded. Yeah. Well, the white collar 1 is back up. White collar 1 is degraded, but it's not.
Is
The, so far as we know, the rate of degradation of white-collar 1 is the same all the time. The sorts of experiments that have been done are to overexpress various of these. So if you overexpress white-collar 1 or white-collar 2, the clock runs along just fine. The level of white-collar 1 is roughly comparable to the level of freak, a little bit more than. But the level of freak cycles a lot more. If you constitutively express freak at a high level, the clock stops. So it seems to be freak that's really driving the this blocking and driving the whole thing.
The sinusoidal one you drew is a caricature, or is it close to sinusoidal?
It's close. And I'll show you some data on that later, but it's close.
I forgot actually,
The level of white collar two does not cycle.
Both of them are not the
same. White collar one cycles. White collar one cycles with about a threefold amplitude. There are about at 25 degrees, there are about 40 molecules of freak on average, or at peak in the nucleus. There are probably about 40 to 50 white collar one, and there are probably about 200 to 300 white collar two. There's a lot more white collar two, and it's the dynamic between white collar one and freak that is setting up this cycling. So this is what I've been talking about then. The freak RNA and protein oscillations are essential for the generation of all circadian rhythms in Neurospora. Changes in freak RNA and protein levels are directly translated into changes in the rhythm, and that's how the clocks are reset. I'll get to that So if I haven't later, but it's be I'd better just walk through it. So I've been talking about Neurospora. So there's a complex white collar complex between white collar one and white collar two. It activates freak, which is translated, processed, makes proteins that are phosphorylated, and freak feeds back to block the activity of that complex. So that's a negative feedback loop, and then there are positive things on that loop. Freak promoting the expression of white collar one, white collar two, and the phosphorylation leading to turnover. There's a similar loop formally operating in mammals. There's a BMAL clock complex, again, two different proteins interacting by pass domains, making a heterodimer that acts as a transcriptional activator. And it activates expression of a whole slew of genes, a couple of homologs of the Drosophila per gene, per 1, per 2, and per 3, and two cryptochrome homologs. These make RNAs and they make proteins, and they make complexes, and those complexes feed back and block the activity of the BMAL clock complex. It's looking now like per 3 is not involved in this, but chief are per 2 and the two cries. Likewise, per 2 promotes the expression of BMAL, And so there are some sort of general similarities between what's going on here and what's going on here, even though the sequences of many of the proteins are different. That's correct. Well, we're not real sure. I think I have the data for this in later, that even if you have constant levels of white collar one RNA, you end up with rhythmic levels of white collar one protein, and that rhythmicity requires rhythmic freak. If you in an inducible system, if you have a constant level of white collar one and you induce freak, and about 4 hours later you get white collar one. That would occur in the cytoplasm. Yeah. All right, so what does the rhythm in Neurospora actually look like? So this is a time-lapse movie taken by Van Gooch. So these are cultures inoculated back here, and they're growing down here at a rate of about 3 centimeters a day. They're growing on auger, and these are in glass tubes.
This is Neurospora.
This is Neurospora. Glass tubes about a centimeter in diameter and about a foot and a half long, bent up at both ends to hold auger. So you inoculate them at this end, and they simply grow down towards the end of the tube. If they're inoculated in the light and then transferred into the dark, Neurospora interprets this as dusk. The sun has gone down, and the biological clock starts running in the same way that we would interpret dusk. And from there on, there's this developmental propensity for development, so that mycelia laid down in the late night are determined, endowed with the capacity to differentiate, and they will differentiate by making aerial hyphae and making spores. And that's what you see here. So they're growing down here. The mycelia laid down here are endowed with the capacity to differentiate. And when the right window of time comes, poof, they do it. Mycelia laid down here will never differentiate in this way, but the mycelia laid down here do. So that's a circadian rhythm. It's a period length of about 24 hours. In wild type, actually 22 hours. It's endogenous and self-sustaining under constant environmental conditions. This is constant darkness. Neurospora grows as a syncytium, so it's more like a muscle cell than a fibroblast, so that nuclei can communicate with one another. But the genetics is haploid, and effectively, under most circumstances, you can treat it as a single cell. There is synchronization between separate mycelia. There have been some really interesting experiments done along those lines by Art Winfrey. So with a mycelial culture like this, you can, for instance, take a baking dish, 6-8 inches wide, inoculate a band across and have a growth front going forward, and then you can take a light pen and shine light on one part, which will cause will reset the rhythm, and then you can see how quickly phase will diffuse across. The rhythm is temperature compensated within the physiological range, and environmental signals, light and temperature, will reset the rhythm. All right, so it's these characteristics that make it a circadian rhythm. For instance, in some organisms, cell cycles have period lengths of close to 24 hours, but they're not endogenous and self-sustaining necessarily. They're not temperature compensated, and they're not reset by environmental cues, so they're not circadian rhythms. But the circadian clock in a cell can regulate the cell cycle. And they're organized at the cellular level. I'm not sure what I've done to get this bar down here. Nope, that was the wrong thing to do. All right, entrainment. Let's see, I want to go back. Yeah, all right. Lighter temperature treatment results in changes in the timing. So this again is a time lapse from Van. All right, so these are a series of race tubes, and they've been inoculated up here, and what Van's done is remove tubes every hour and give them a temperature pulse. Okay, and you can see when they're being removed across here. So here's the first day of banding after the temperature pulse. Now you're going to see resetting of the rhythm. Here there's relatively little effect in the rhythm. Here you can see there are delays and advances of the rhythm. All right, so the same 1 hour temperature pulse given at all these different times of day, but in some cases you get an effect, and in some cases you get very little effect. Here's the control there and there.
What are your temperature pulses?
This is a 1 hour pulse at 38 degrees, and they've been growing at 25. But you can see the effect with a smaller amplitude pulse than that. Neurospora will entrain to cycles of of 1.5 degrees C, which is interesting given there's about a 1 degree centigrade temperature cycle in people. So connecting the controls, that's the line of zero phase shift. Here there are delays, and here there are advances. And this plotting is something that's seen in all circadian systems. This is how entrainment works. And the jargon is called a phase response curve because it measures the response of the organism's clock to a standard cue at different phases of the circadian cycle. So this is subjective daytime over here, and this is subjective nighttime over here. So again, teleologically, it has to be this way light or temperature are going to be useful for resetting. You could substitute here light pulses. Light given in the early evening delays the clock back into the previous day. Light given late in the night advances the clock into the next day, which is sort of how it ought to work. And generally, high temperature corresponds to light. Third time we've seen something like this now, and the result are these rhythms in freak RNA, freak protein, and white collar one. So what do they actually look like? So rhythms in freak RNA, freak protein. So these are northerns, these are westerns, these are northerns, looking at RNA and looking at protein. Samples taken every 3 to 4 hours over about 2 days in the dark. This is the densitometer here. So you can see that the RNA cycles here in black, so it's not quite a sine wave, a little more pointy. And this is the protein cycling, phase lagging the RNA as you'd expect. Looking at the protein, you see that a couple of things. It's not a simple Western. There's more than one species there, and the average molecular weight is changing over the course of the day, and that's the phosphorylation that we've been talking about. So freak is phosphorylated in a time of day specific manner. So this is a blow up of what we saw before. Clearly, a big change in not only the amount of freak protein, but also in the mobility. If these are taken and immunoprecipitated and treated with lambda phosphatase, which just pulls out all the phosphates, what you see are two species, a long form and a short form. And the amount of both of those is changing. At high temperatures, there's more of the large form, and at low temperatures, there's more of the small form. But either form will work in the mid-range of temperatures. Phosphorylation. This is data of Ease when he was a postdoc in our lab. We know at least phosphorylation of amino acid 513 is important for freak degradation, and subsequent work in some other groups has shown that other phosphorylation sites are also important for freak degradation. So here's a wild type race tube with a daily rhythm on banding 22-hour period length. In these experiments, looked at given cyclohexamide to stop synthesis of freak and simply looked at the rate of turnover of the protein. He found a phosphate on serine 513. If he changes that serine to an isoleucine so it can no longer be phosphorylated, the protein becomes more stable. And likewise, he did a serine to aspartate, and that changed the stability of the protein. That stability is graphed over here, wild type aspartate substitution and isoleucine substitution. And the result of this increased stability in protein is that the period length of the clock gets much longer, going from 22 hours up to 33 hours. When we did the aspartate substitution, what we were hoping for was something that looked like constitutive phosphorylation. The negative charge in the aspartate we were imagining would mimic a phosphate. It apparently didn't. We simply got an arrhythmic culture. So phosphate's probably doing more, or at least the constitutive phosphate at that site is doing more than just regulating turnover. But this result is pretty unambiguous, I think. When the stability of freak and the turnover kinetics of freak have a lot to do with the period length of the clock.
So the ratio of the highs and the low level, which is
Of the long form versus short form, you mean, or the?
No, the during the daily period, the maximum.
It's 5 to 10-fold. Freak action in the nucleus. So there's a single nuclear localization, good consensus nuclear localization signal here. So what we did, this is work of graduate student Cheng Ma Luo. If you took the NLS out of here and moved it to the region between the first and second AUG, so this, when you make the long form of the protein, you started here. When you make the short form of the protein, you started here. All right. So in this construct, the long form will have a nuclear localization signal. The short form won't have a nuclear localization signal. And this is just the molecular conformation of this. Looking over here with phosphate treated, so we can see the two forms. If you've removed the first AUG, you can only make a short form, and that's there. If you've removed the second, the third AUG, you only make the long form, so that's there. In a wild type strain, you have both. In Cheng Ma's construct here, you have both in a total lysate. But when you look in the nucleus, in a wild type strain, you have both. But in her mutant, only the long form is getting into the nucleus. And the biology of that is here. These are transformants now. A wild type clock, if you remove the NLS, they are arrhythmic. The clock doesn't run. If you have the NLS in, so it's only in the long form of the protein, the clock runs fine at 25 degrees. At 27 degrees, where the long form is made, or preferred, the clock runs. But at 22 degrees, where the short form is preferred, the clock's not running.
The short and long forms are from the same gene, but one's a modification of the protein, or
there? Yeah, it's apparently it's alternative splicing. So the temperature regulated alternative splicing. So that when the first AUG is not there, then they'll start from the third one. Yeah, Chris.
Is the polymerization of brick is necessary for dentine nucleus?
We don't know. I don't know. I don't think that's been followed. Yeah.
So the short form is functional?
The short form is functional. You may need more of it. We don't really understand the biology of that still. Right, why it would be necessary. And I, at this point, I have to agree. It's a gap.
Does nuclear localization affect either phosphorylation rates or degradation rates?
We don't know. That's a good question.
How fast is the nuclear localization compared to...
It's pretty fast. The freak turns up in the nucleus almost as soon as it's made.
So it does not introduce any interesting delay into.
No, not apparently in Neurospora. Not so far as we know.
Where is the main delay that makes the 24 hours or 22 hours?
I would guess the main delay is in the turnover kinetics, based on what we know so far. And this. Yes, the phosphorylation. That's right. And that's going to be something different, I think, between what we're seeing and probably what's seen in flies. There are other delays there.
And can only be conservated as a dimer?
We don't know. That would be attractive for modeling. If they had to dimerize or if they had to be phosphorylated in order at one particular site in order to get into the nucleus. But at this point, we don't know, and it'd be a little hard to get at. It'd be a good question for how to do it. Okay, again, touching back to this to remind us what we're looking at. Heterodimer activating freak, making proteins, feeding back, and freak also positively regulating some things. All right, so how is, you would ask, how light gets into this. So white color 1 and white color 2 are both a part of the clock, and they're also required for the light signaling. So this is in response to a 2-minute pulse of light. looking at freak RNA starting here. So in the absence of light, RNA levels are lower, but it's there. When the organism sees light, there's an induction of freak, and it happens pretty quickly. This is minutes after the light pulse. In a white collar 1 loss of function mutant, there's less freak RNA in the dark, and there's no light induction. And in a white collar 2 mutant, in a loss of function, a deletion mutant, there's no freak protein in the dark, and there's no freak protein induced by light. So white collar 1 and white collar 2 are required for light induction of freak. Also, they're simply required for production of freak in the dark. Again, here in wild type, this is the daily rhythm we've been talking about in freak transcript and in freak protein. Here we used a 4 degree centigrade to 25 degree centigrade step to start the clock running, rather than using a light pulse. We knew that white collar 1 and white collar 2 were required for seeing light, so we used something other than light to start the clock running. All right. In white collar 1, again, there's no freak RNA. There's essentially no freak protein. And following this temperature step, there's no rhythm running. And likewise with white collar 2. This is a partial loss of function mutant. So we get production the first day, but not thereafter. Likewise, low protein production and no rhythm. So white collar 1 and white collar 2 are required not only for the clock to run in the dark, as I've been saying before, but also for light. So cartoons of the proteins required for light induction of transcript, the heterodimerized via their pass domains, and they contain zinc finger DNA binding domains and transcriptional activation domains. So what I'm doing here is picking up some of the molecular details of things that I've been telling you. White collar 1, white collar 2, and freak associate or can associate. These are immunoprecipitations with anti-white collar 2 done at 2 different times a day. And what you see is that white collar 2 pulls down both white collar 1 and freak. Interesting harmonics. A partially functional allele of white collar 2 displays altered period length and temperature compensation. So we did this experiment, and this is testing the prediction that white collar 1 and white collar 2 are a part of the feedback loop that you ought to be able to mutate things other than just period length, that some alleles should be altered in more than one canonical clock property. So this is a partial loss of function mutant in white collar 2. Here are the race tubes that we've seen before, and this is looking across temperatures within the physiological range. So here's the data for temperature compensation that I've been mentioning. So it's not flat, but there's a relatively small change in period length with temperature. But in this mutant, it still keeps time, but temperature compensation is clearly defective, along with the period length being long. That's a good question. I should have the answer on the top of my head. I think it's a mutation. This is an allele with a mutation in the zinc binding, the zinc finger DNA binding domain, so it doesn't bind DNA as well. Levels of white collar 1 and freak cycle, and they cycle in antiphase to one another. These are the westerns at the top. So this is done in wild type and in a long period mutant of freak. It has a period length of about 29 hours at 25 degrees. So here's freak and white collar 1 cycling in wild type, which is which. This is white collar 1 here, and this is freak cycling here. The confirmation this is really clock regulated is to look in the long period mutant. And showing here that white collar 1 and freak are cycling with a long period length and cycling out of phase.
Do you have any more hours? Because it looks like it's damped.
Is that just the experiment? It does. It does, and we don't.
In one of the previous slides, I meant
Yeah. Free, this, let's see, what's happening? These data are good enough to be characterized as typical. That is to say, these data have been selected and these are the best we ever saw for the white collar one cycling. It tends to be much lower amplitude than freak. Freak is absolutely dependable. And in cultures taken out as long as we have, which is about 4 days, it continues to cycle. White collar one, I don't think this cycling is here, and it's appealing in terms of putting together a feedback loop, but I don't think it's essential for the clock to run. So there may be some damping there. But we haven't followed it out for as long as we followed Freak. Okay. Let's see. So this is just explaining a technique that I'm going to use here and later. This is an inducible Freak construct. There's a transcriptional activator that's a heterodimer of two different proteins that binds to regions in the QA2 promoter. So in this construct, we've taken this activatable promoter and we're using it to drive Freak expression. So when we add activator, quinic acid, we produce Freak. So there are some questions about how Freak promotes, how this positive feedback of Freak on white collar one works. So here are the data for this. In the interest of time, I'm just going to skip this part and focus down here. So this is with a constitutive amount of white collar one protein in a strain that has inducible Freak. And what we see is we add inducer, we get Freak production here coming up at 4 and 8 hours, and then phase lagged after that, we see production of white collar one. And in a control that doesn't contain the inducible construct, so it's just wild type Neurospora, adding quinic acid doesn't produce this effect. And the densitometry is over here, a control showing no induction. And in the inducible strain showing Freak coming up and then white collar one coming up after that. The model again, remind us what we're looking at. All right, so I wanted to spend a little time on for the promotion of white collar one by, we don't know. At this point, just no data. Yes?
Anyone look at the environment stability control? Because I heard some talks from people working on plants that environment stability changes a lot during day and night.
Yeah.
Is there any measurement on environment stability?
It should be on here. This would be the white collar one RNA following addition of inducer. Yes. Right. So if there was a stability over this period of time, 1, 2, and 3, I don't think that's ours. I think it's lane numbers. Well, it's the same period of time as here, though. So over the period of time when we're seeing induction of protein, we're not seeing a substantial, certainly not induction of RNA. So that's as good as the evidence gets. So I think it's post-translational. It could be protein stability. Well, it could be translational promotion of translation of white collar one, or it could be stability of white collar one protein of the recently synthesized white collar one protein. That is, if Another model that's compatible with this is if white collar 1 is stable once it's complexed with white collar 2, but not stable before it's complexed, then freak could affect the stability of that class of de novo synthesized white collar 1, and that would work. But we just haven't, this is all the data there is at this point. White collar 2 is constant, and there's more of it than white collar 1. So if freak stabilized white collar 1 prior to its association with white collar 2. Yes. So if that's what we've seen before, doing immunoprecipitations. So that's why I say it's this. The data suggests that it's not a stability issue, that it's a translational issue. But if there were a small amount of white collar 1 that we're not seeing by the IPs, that is just the de novo synthesized white collar 1. If that was less stable, so we didn't see it, and freak promoted its stability until it could be associated, then that would work too.
Does freak interact with white collar 2 without being associated with white collar 1?
I don't know.
I'm just wanting to change the binding ability of white collar 1 to white collar 2.
I don't know. And the reason I don't is that you'd have to do it with in vitro translated proteins, really, in order to do it right, because there's so much cross-regulation among the proteins. What you'd like to do is delete white collar 1 and look at a strain that contains only white collar 2 and freak. But by deleting white collar 1, you get less freak. So then you try to put it in a QA strain to make more freak. But freak's also promoting the expression of white collar 1 transcript, which makes more white collar 1 or white collar 2 transcript, which makes more white collar 2 protein. So it just gets very messy. The white collar 2 level is
time independent?
Is time, the white collar 2 protein level is time independent.
So I guess I'm confused about that because there were various feedbacks onto at least the transcription of white collar 2.
Yes. So the transcription of white collar 2
oscillates, but on the protein level, the statement is that it is somehow possible.
Yes, probably by stability. But what we know, let's see. Yeah, I was just looking for an example feedback loop. What we know is that if there's no freak protein, that there's much less white collar 2 around. But biochemically measuring white collar 2.
Okay, but there is no feedback because I just got confused between 1 and 2. I thought there was a positive feedback from the complex onto white collar 2.
Not from the white collar complex on the white collar 2. Right.
So presumably the amount of free white collar 2 will oscillate as the concentration of the.
Yes, it could. It could.
Oscillates. But the total amount, which is what you're measuring, is.
Yeah. That's possible. Or the amount synthesized could oscillate. This is seen with for instance, albumin in the blood in people, the rate of synthesis of albumin is rhythmic, but the total amount of albumin doesn't change because there's so much of it there. Same thing is true with late harvesting pigments in plants. They're made during the day, but there's so much there that if you simply look biochemically at the amount, there's no rhythm. Okay, looking at temperature changes. So this is looking at cycling of organisms at 21 degrees and 28 degrees. So this is sort of at towards either end of the physiological range. And comparing the two temperatures, looking at RNA levels, the RNA rhythms pretty much overlie one another. So there's not a big temperature effect on the amount of freak RNA. But there is a temperature effect on the amount of freak protein, which you can see in the westerns here and densitometry here. At a lower temperature, levels cycle around a lower level, and at a higher temperature, they cycle around a higher level. So that gives a model for temperature resetting. I mentioned that the amount of freak protein really, in a real way, defines time of day. That low freak protein levels are seen around dawn, high freak protein levels are seen around dusk. So if the organism is cycling along at 21 degrees and there's a temperature step up, at any time at 21 degrees, during a step up or following a step up, the amount of protein in the cell immediately after the step is going to be low compared to the amount that's normally seen in the high temperature cycling. So it doesn't matter if it's late night, early morning, or late in the day, it's still a low amount of protein. And so steps up then would tend to reset the clock to the low point of freak, which is about dawn, and that's what they do. Conversely, the organism cycling at 28 degrees, so there's a lot of freak around. Any time when you step to 21 degrees, there will be a lot of freak compared to the amount that's seen cycling at 21 degrees. So a step from high temperature to low temperature would tend to reset the clock towards dusk. To a time corresponding to dusk, which is what they do. Okay, so how does light work? Light-induced clock resetting increases in proportion to light induction of freak. So this is seconds of light, 25 lux is very dim light. And you see a few seconds of dim light is sufficient to give a large induction of freak. What we've done here is graphed the clock effect, the phase advance, like I showed in those race tubes, phase advance here, and the induction of freak here. So you can see there's a threshold around here of about 30 seconds of dim light. That's the threshold for clock resetting and also for freak induction. So the model for clock resetting would be this. So these are northerns. So this is the cycling of freak in the dark. And at any time when you turn the lights on, you get this massive induction of freak. So the controls cycling along here in black. If RNA levels are going down and the organism sees light, you get an induction of freak back to peak. It cycles from there, and that would give a phase delay. If RNA levels are rising but haven't reached the peak yet, the organism sees light, you get an induction to peak, and they cycle from there, and that would give a phase advance. So what I've done here is plotted the phase response curve, like what I showed you earlier, and superimposed that with the daily rhythm and freak transcript levels measured biochemically. So in the late night to early morning, RNA levels are rising slowly, and they're going to peak about midday. Out here, if they're low, the organism sees light, there's an induction to peak, and the organism would run from there. So that would effectively take time that was here, late night, and advance it to here. So that would be a phase advance. And out here, levels are low, a shift sends them back to peak, and that's a phase delay. So this is, to relate this to something real, so this is data published in collaboration with Hitoshi Okamura's lab at Kobe University, which is where these experiments were done. This is coronal sections through a mouse brain, so it's basically down through the ears to capture the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is where the clock is running. So here are the paired suprachiasmatic nuclei, and these are stained for MPER1, which is a mammalian homologue of the Drosophila per gene that's involved in keeping time. So just like I've been saying with Freak, there's a daily rhythm in the amount of PER1, and it's phased in the same way that the Freak is phased. It peaks during the daytime, which is here, and is very low in the middle of the night, which is here. That's just like Freak. If a mouse sees light in the middle of the night, you get this big induction of PER within the SCN. All right, so if you...
Do those keep running in slices for some time?
They will, yeah. They will even run in dissociated cultures for a while. You can plate fetal SCN cells out on microelectrode grids. Do you know what I mean? Does it ring a bell? And they will cycle for months.
And you can electrostimulate it in ways that's roughly analogous to light?
No, people use glutamate shifts. They're glutamate receptors, and that seems to be the neurotransmitter. But yes, you can do that. So if you were to leave Santa Barbara and fly to Hawaii, for instance, I can't imagine why you'd do that, but you'd arrive at Hawaii late in the day in Hawaii, but that would be nighttime here, be 11 or 12 at night, probably. I'm not sure what the hour difference is. But when you walk off the plane, you're going to see light. So light's going to go in here. It's going to go back to your clock back here. PER1 levels will be low. The light will cause an increase in PER1, and that will cause a phase delay. If you fly...
What is the light detector in Neurospora?
In Neurospora, it's white collar 1, and it's and the chromophore is a flavin.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we're getting to now. All right. So, and the converse is true when you fly to the East Coast. You you fly from here to London. You walk off the plane. PER1 levels are low. You see light. It gets induced, and you get a phase advance. So the essential point of understanding phase shifting by light is that it's the same molecular event, but the clock interprets it differently, advance or delay, depending on where you are in the cycle when it happens.
By always staying inside of the light room, will you constantly ring another clock?
The answer is no, but it's an excellent question. There are loops that close around the clock, I mean that the clock also regulates its own input. So light seen at some times a day has a greater effect than light seen at other times a day in terms of the clock effect. So there are at the gross level when we're sleeping our eyelids are closed, so light. Late exposure at night doesn't get in. At a finer level, even if the eyelids are open, for instance, in mice, the amount of PER that is induced by a given amount of light changes over the course of the day. So the organism is using the clock to gate its own input. So if you're sitting in a room with constant light, the clock is still running, and it's gating its own input. All right. So, how are light signals perceived and transduced to the clock? So we said that Freak transcript is rapidly and highly induced in response to light, and that results in a phase shift. And white collar 1 and white collar 2 are required for the light induction. But what I haven't really said yet is whether there are things upstream or downstream from white collar one and white collar two. So to get at this, graduate student Alan Frelick resected the freak promoter and looked for the light responsive elements. And he found two. There's one, there's a proximal light responsive element and a distal one. And this is the necessary argument there. If you remove the distal one, you lose some of the light induction. If you remove the proximal one, you lose some of the light induction. If you remove both, you lose all the light induction. There's another slide that I took out that is the sufficiency argument. You can take either one of these elements and put them in front of a naive promoter and confer light regulation. The LREs are bound by white collar one and white collar two. These are gel shifts. Are you familiar with gel shifts, or is it worth going through this even? If you make nuclear extracts from Neurospora and give them a radioactively labeled DNA corresponding to the light regulatory element, the proteins in the nuclear extract will bind to the element, and in electrophoresis it'll move more slowly because it's a bigger complex. And you'd expect that if you use non-radioactively labeled DNA, it should compete. If you use non-labeled DNA that doesn't have the same sequence, it shouldn't compete, and it doesn't. And if you use antisera against white collar 1 and white collar 2, the shifted band disappears. It gets shifted to something higher because the complex is even bigger. But when you use antisera to freak, the complex is still there. So white collar 1 and white collar 2 are binding to the LREs, but freak is not. Proximal and distal LREs are bound by distinct complexes in the light and dark. This is the proximal, this is the distal. This is a non-specific complex here, but in the dark, there's this one, and in the light, there's a higher mobility complex. So what causes the change? You can imagine a number of scenarios. You can imagine a number of possible photoreceptors. So we've been talking about white collar 1 and white collar 2. I didn't mention Vivid. It's a past protein that we've identified in Neurospora. It turns out also to be a photoreceptor, but not the one that's working with the clock. There's a cryptochrome, there are a couple of phytochromes, and there's an opsin, all in Neurospora.
So this LOV domain is...
LOV domain is a kind of past domain. That is, it if you take... Yeah, it has everything to do with light. Yep. So it's a good question. LOV comes from light, oxygen, and voltage. So in a one of these sort of meta-analyses papers where someone took all of the known past domains and looked at what proteins they were associated with and whether there were subgroups within those, they found a subgroup of proteins that were more similar by sequence, and those that were more similar by sequence were involved in sensing either light or oxygen redox or voltage. So they call this a love domain, but it's really a past domain. White collar 1 and Vivid both have these love domains, white collar 2 doesn't. It is a regular past domain. So here is the key experiment. Alan showed that you could take nuclear extracts if you made them in the dark, actually made them under red light, which Neurospora doesn't see, and then brought the extracts out into the lab under light. So if you isolate the extracts in the dark and run the gels in the dark, you get this band. If you isolate them in the dark and run them in the light, you get both. If you isolate, and here's the key, if you isolate them in the dark and expose them to light, you get the light band. So that you don't need the whole cell to see light, the extracts themselves can see light. So that means you could do the biochemistry. But before we did the biochemistry, to make sure we weren't pursuing some artifact, we wanted to correlate the amount of light and the quality of light with the biochemical effect, and correlate that with the biology of the system. So that's what's here. So in vitro light-induced white collar complex late regulatory element mobility change occurs at biologically relevant intensities. So this is the light complex, this is the dark complex. So extracts isolated in the dark and then exposed to increasing amounts of light and watching the dark complex turn into the light complex. The in vivo threshold for phase shifting is down here. That was a couple of slides back when I showed the induction of Freak and the light phase shifting effect. And I guess that's here again. So here's the induction of Freak in the bars. Here's the phase shifting effect here. This is happening about 24 micromoles photons. And this was for two light regulatory elements in the organism. And this is obviously a single light regulatory element in a test tube. So the agreement's pretty good. The in vitro light-induced mobility change occurs at relevant wavelengths. So here, Alan's taken this amount of light that gives about half change and given that number of photons of different wavelengths. And you get an action spectrum here with a peak here. And that correlates pretty well with data from Winslow Briggs' lab about 30 years ago. Let's see. So I've been talking for about an hour. How are we doing? Is this...
Where are you at?
If I were going to take an hour and 20 minutes, about where I'd be. But I can...
Another 10 minutes.
Okay.
So can I just... If people want to get to the launch, the other thing is growth of the team. Sorry to remind you.
Sorry.
That's what I was saying to you. So, sorry, we're just having a private conversation. It just does raise a problem for the next. Sorry.
Well, how about we just sacrifice a break?
No. And, he needs to have a
next talk.
How much time do we need to get?
We'll wrap it up here pretty quickly. So the punchline here is that.
Sorry to do this, but can I say there's a lunch at 12:15 which people are supposed to go to. Sorry,
come. No, that's. Yep. So it's FAD that they're.
Yes, we can do that very easily. How about we have a second talk at 2 o'clock?
Yes. Is that all right for you? That would be much
that
better.
That would be great.
That's much more.
That's not running into any, nobody's teaching a class here.
No.
Peter, is that all right?
Yes, that's
sure.
Much better.
What?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock?
So keep going. Sorry, too.
No.
But that's much better. Yeah. I was just getting very worried.
Now, I suppose in the spirit of things, I've been answering, taking
exactly
my time.
Idea.
Okay.
And, we have considerable flexibility here.
All right. So it's white collar 2 and white collar 1. White collar 1 binds FAD, flavonadenine dinucleotide, and that is the chromophore. When it detects light, something magical happens, apparently, and the dark band, which is a single homodimer, turns into the light band, which is a pair of homodimers. And this was determined by expressing these in vitro, so using reticulocyte lysates to make the protein. If you just make the protein but don't add any FAD, you get some of both complexes, but there's no light responsivity. If you add FAD, you get, and keep it in the dark, you get less of the light complex and more of the dark complex. And if you expose it to light, you get more of the light complex.
You put a number down of something in micromoles or photons per square meter or something like that. If I translate that into photons per cell, that are absorbed.
That'd be a tough translation to do, because so little would be absorbed. So little of the volume of the culture would be the surface area would be photoreceptor.
Well, I guess what I'm worried about is it primarily from cell to cell that a few of the cells detect the light and then communicate this to the other cells? Or is it something which each cell is getting?
Well, each cell is the same.
Right, but the number, it sounds like it's extremely small number of photons per cell, if I'm curious.
No, it'd be micromoles per meter squared would be that'd be a lot of photons.
The same question, saying, well, if you have a concentration of a substance in micromolar, this is a small amount of molecules, right? You still are in the micromolar.
No, the square meter is a meter is a very large unit in regards to the cell. So if we look at per square, look at it per square micron.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent calculation to do.
10 to the minus 18
photons per square micron. And surely there are not many molecules around there. Because that's something very big. Yeah, so one can almost calculate the quantum efficiency of.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, whether the cell is off communication or each cell is getting reset.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. All right, so we're getting 24, so let's call that 30. A threshold of 30 micromoles of photons per meter squared. So you're going to have to help me with this.
10 to 7.
Okay, so 30 times 10 to the minus 6 moles per meter squared times 10 to the 6 microns. That's meters times 6 times 10 to the 23 photons per mole. So we got 23 minus 18 is 30 times 10 to the 5th photons per micron. Have I done this right? Yeah. So 3 times 10 to the 6 photons per. So it's still. Okay. It's good to self check. It's a good calculation. Okay. So, summary, how are they perceived? Light is perceived by FAD, and that causes this dimerization of the dimers, and therefore white color 1 is a circadian blue light photoreceptor. We've been talking about the these events and the wavy lines, how light is getting in to reset the clock. I haven't really talked very much about how white collar 1 and white collar 2 are involved in the actions of the promoter, and that's the last part. The distal LRE is necessary for the rhythm, so I talked about light reception, but if you take out the distal LRE, not only do they lose some of the light, but they also lose the ability to keep time, so they're not rhythmic anymore. And that's seen both at molecular level and following a temperature step. So it's not simply light sensing, it's that this is the clock pertinent part of the promoter. It is rhythmically transcribed. If you take a naive promoter and put the distal LRE in front of it, you get rhythmic transcription. So the distal LRE is a circadian element. The distal LRE is rhythmically bound by the white collar complex. So these are gel shifts with extracts taken at different times of day. And there's a rhythm here, a low amplitude rhythm. And that's plotted here. This is the LRE binding from extracts, and this is the amount of freak. So as expected then, the activator, the rhythm and activator binding phase leads the amount of protein. When protein's expressed, the amount of binding decreases. So that's consistent with the model. The proof is to overexpress this and see what happens to binding. And that's here. Again, using this inducible construct. So these are experiments done at the high point of complex binding. This is hours after induction. You see there's a big induction of freak. Over 4 hours, there's relatively little effect on white collar 1 and white collar 2. But there's a big drop in the amount of complex seen in the gel shift, and that's plotted densitometrically here. That expressing freak for 1 hour gives about a 3 to 4-fold drop in, 3-fold drop in complex. And then it goes down a little bit more. The amount of freak expressed here, here after an hour, is about the amount seen at peak during the normal circadian cycle in the dark. So that gives this model for what's happening over the course of the day. At dawn, freak is low but is increasing. White collar binding, white collar complex binding is decreasing, but freak transcription is high. By mid-subjective day, the amount of freak is increasing towards a maximum late in the day. White collar complex binding has decreased to a minimum. Because there's no activator binding, freak transcript is falling. At dusk, freak is becoming phosphorylated, beginning to decrease. White collar complex binding still is very low, and by now freak RNA has decayed away, so it's low. And by midnight, freak has become sufficiently phosphorylated that it precipitously turns over and is low. This releases white collar complex binding to happen, so it's either increasing or maximal. But freak RNA concentrations are low, and freak transcript is being actively made.
So in the precipitosity of the freak turnover?
Let's see. So we looked at that. I think we're done here now, so we can go back and pick up things that we... So that's the precipitosity. In the next slide also. So made, phosphorylated, and then disappearing. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's well stated. That's how we're looking at it. But that's only an intuitive model. We don't have any data yet. So that's consistent then.
Yeah.
There is data on that. The peak, it goes up in the nucleus before it goes up in the cytoplasm. So very soon after freak is translated, it begins turning up in the nucleus. The phosphorylation is, so far as we know, happening both places. We haven't looked at degradation also. We haven't really looked at the, and we don't know how it's degraded. It's a great set of questions, but yeah. Again, not known.
Freak levels are increased when you increase the temperature. What's the mechanism or why does that happen? I mean, it's obviously compensated, should be in milk, but.
So the question is, why does the amount of free protein increase as the temperature increases? And the answer is, we don't really know. The processing of free message is very complex, which we didn't appreciate initially. There are two promoters, and there's alternative splicing of several transcripts. Of the transcripts from the two promoters, so you get about six different forms. There's also an antisense transcript that I haven't talked about at all, that a long antisense transcript that runs from a promoter outside the 3' end all the way through the open reading frame. So it's about a 4.5 kb transcript that is light induced and that is clock regulated, although it's expressed at a much lower level than the sense transcript. So the short answer is we don't know. We don't know why it's changing with temperature, but there are a number of possible ways in which it could be.
Yeah.
Well, apparently it's regulating the sense transcript. There are no coding regions within it. This is work from, again, a former postdoc, Sue Crosswaite, and it was just published in Nature in February.
So you drew your picture of the white collar customer as it's going through the four DNA binding domain directly and binding the DNA.
Right. No, it's just we know what the consensus sequence for the light regulatory element is, and it's about eight bases long. So based on that, there'd only be room. So that would be a typical GATA zinc finger type size to bind. So based on that, we cartooned it as stacking up rather than binding next to each other. But there's no, yes. Yeah, we know that both elements are bound in that way. That is, you can get the dark to light shift in vitro with either just the proximal or just the distal, but there certainly could be some sort of looping involved. Yeah. So what do we do here? I'm perfectly happy to, this is fun, but people may be burning out. I'm done. Yeah. Yeah, these are sort of the experiments that Winfrey was interested in doing. So asking the question, how fast does phase diffuse? So in that experiment, so here's a baking dish. It's 9 by 13 baking dish. With a band of mycelia growing forward, and then he phase shifts a region over here with a light pen, and then asks how quickly the phase shift is propagated And it turns out it's propagated fairly slowly. Hours per millimeter. No, because they're growing as a syncytium. So it's actually organelles can be sloshing back and forth.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good.